From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Amy Tan's first novel, The Joy Luck Club, was the story of Chinese emigre women and their Americanized daughters. On this edition of Fresh Air, Amy Tan tells us why she decided to tell her own mother's story in her new novel. Also today, we talk with law professor Patricia Williams. Her new book examines the relation between prejudice in society and prejudice in the law. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new albums by the New York bands Curlew and Dr. Nerve. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us why she's still Maureen Corrigan. She recently got married, but she's keeping her name. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Authorities in Medellin, Colombia, say that the man alleged to be the country's top drug trafficker has surrendered to police. Pablo Escobar, said to have become a billionaire as head of the Medellin cocaine cartel, was reportedly taken by helicopter to a specially prepared jail. Escobar is said to have been negotiating the surrender with the Colombian government for weeks, insisting on protection from his enemies while he's in jail and demanding to keep his drug earnings. The committee writing Colombia's new constitution today included a provision that would prevent Colombian citizens from being extradited. That's believed to have been another of Escobar's conditions for surrender. A Kuwaiti martial law court has sentenced seven more suspected Iraqi collaborators to life in prison, despite growing charges from the international community that the trials are unfair. NPR's John Burnett reports from Kuwait City.
In the name of God the Merciful, the Compassionate, I hereby sentence you for life after all the charges against you have been proven true. With this statement, the Kuwait Martial Court judge sentenced a Jordanian and six Iraqis to life in prison. They include an actor and actress who late last year participated in a celebration with Iraqi forces in Kuwait. Since the military trials began on May 24th, 21 people have been sentenced to death and many others have received prison terms varying from 5 years to life. Yesterday, U.N. Secretary General Javier Pérez de Cuellar urged clemency for six journalists sentenced to death for allegedly working on a pro-Iraqi newspaper published in occupied Kuwait. Both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch have condemned the military trials, saying they lack the most basic elements of due process. In Kuwait City, I'm John Burnett.
A U.S. district judge in New Orleans has set a trial date for next month to consider the constitutionality of Louisiana's new abortion law. The state legislature overrode Governor Buddy Romer's veto of the bill last night, setting the stage for a possible Supreme Court challenge to the right to abortion. Russ Wise reports.
Federal Judge Adrian Duplanchet refused to issue a restraining order, saying in effect that you can't restrain something which isn't there. Under the terms of the Louisiana State Constitution, the law won't take effect until 60 days after the legislative session ends, no earlier than August 28th, and perhaps not until early in September. But Judge Duplanchet decided instead to go right to the heart of the matter and ordered that a trial on the constitutional merits of the abortion bill itself be held. The trial's to begin July 23rd. Until then, doctors and private clinics in Louisiana will still be able to perform abortions. Attorney General William Gust is saying so in a letter he's sending to every sheriff and district attorney in the state, saying in part, it would not be proper to try to enforce the new act. For National Public Radio, I'm Russ Wise in Baton Rouge.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 31 points to close at 2,955.5. This is NPR. A group of American economists told Congress today that an administration proposal to help solve the Soviet economic crisis was too modest and doomed to failure. The economists were part of a Harvard group that worked on the so-called Grand Bargain plan with Soviet economist Grigory Yavlinsky. The Grand Bargain calls for Western aid to help cushion the impact of a 7-year program of economic and democratic reforms in the Soviet Union. Yesterday in Berlin, Secretary of State James Baker said that Western nations could help the Soviet Union without spending a massive amount of cash. The U.S. Conference of Mayors has ended its annual meeting, passing over 100 resolutions. Wanda Levine of member station KPBS reports.
Dozens of well-crafted measures on economic policies, health care, and environmental issues form a thick book of resolutions whose fate is unknown. Majority support was given to an anti-recession package which calls for Congress to pass legislation similar to measures in the mid-70s that provided funds to local public works projects. Boston's Mayor Raymond Flynn, one of the three mayors who submitted the resolution, says creating jobs is the only way to lift our sagging economy.
What we're looking for is not only to improve the infrastructure and the environment of our cities and our country, but also getting people back to work.
Before concluding the conference, the mayors elected Flynn as their new president. For National Public Radio, I'm Wanda Levine in San Diego.
A survey compiled by two Swiss business groups shows that Japan is still the world's most competitive business and trading nation. The United States moved from third place to second, largely because of weaker economies in its closest rivals, Germany and Switzerland. The survey reviewed what it described as the competitive environment of 24 industrial nations and 10 developing countries. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Amy Tan is that rare writer whose first novel was both a critical success and a bestseller. That book, The Joy Luck Club, juxtaposed the stories of four Chinese women who fled their country in the 40s with the stories of their Americanized daughters. Tan says she didn't want her second book to be Son of Joy Luck. She started and abandoned several different books on totally unrelated subjects before she came up with her new novel, The Kitchen God's Wife. And in a way, this new book is what she promised herself she wasn't going to do. It's about the relationship between a Chinese mother who fled her country in the 40s and her Americanized daughter. Both the mother and daughter are keeping secrets from each other, secrets each thinks the other would be totally unable to comprehend or accept. But a sick relative threatens to divulge the secrets unless mother and daughter reveal their secrets to each other. Most of the novel is given over to the mother's story, about life with her first husband, a cruel man who repeatedly raped her. There was a good reason Amy Tan returned to the territory of telling a Chinese mother's story.
It was a request from my mother. She had spent so many times having to tell her friends and acquaintances that she was not the mothers in the Joy Luck Club. And she came up to me one day and she said, as I was struggling to write the second book, she said, "Next book, tell my true story." And with her request, you know, how could I refuse? Because she had been really so much a part of the first book. She wanted me to write more about what had actually happened to her in China. And for such a long time, I knew just the sketchiest of details. I had always felt that it would be too painful for her to talk about everything that had really gone on, all the worst things. And so I asked her more and more about the times that she had lost her children or about her marriage to a very terrible man, a man whose name she could not even tell me until that time when she finally said, "Please tell my story." And she told me the name of the man, and I changed it, of course, but that became really the reason why I wrote The Kitchen God's Wife.
I'm really shocked that your mother, who seems not to be very public, would want to make her story public through your novel.
Well, she knew that I would fictionalize things, and I assured her of that as well. I said, "I know that you want me to tell this true story, but at the same time, I'm going to change a lot of things. Is that okay?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "And that way, if it is too uncomfortable for you, if people think this is you and you are embarrassed, then you can tell them, no, it's fiction." And she said, "Yes." But I think what happened is that when she read The Joy Luck Club, she knew that I changed things, but she also had gone through a transformation in seeing feelings that she had finally come to life, and she could now let go of a lot of things, let go of a lot of pain. And I think she was ready to let go of the greatest pain of her life. And that I could help her do it by talking it through and reliving it again. We could together share this and then both let go without regrets.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from The Kitchen God's Wife. And this is a passage in which the mother has a lot of difficulty.
Yes.
Talking to the daughter, because it's such a painful part and it's such a personal part. And it's a passage where the mother's telling the daughter about how the mother's first husband abused her sexually and physically.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say in setting up this passage?
Well, this is a scene that happens when she has been married for only a few months. She is telling her daughter about the time that they lived in Hangzhou when her husband was training to become an Air Force pilot. And in this, she talks about the loss, the early loss, beginning loss of her innocence. "And now I have come to the part where I must be frank. I was thinking I should not talk about these things with you, sex things. But if I didn't tell you, then you would not understand why I changed, how he changed. So I will tell you what happened, although maybe not everything. Maybe I'll come to a part where I cannot say any more. And when that happens, you just have to imagine what happened. And then you should imagine it again and make it 10 times worse. Every night when Fu wanted me, and it was not the same way as when we were at his parents' house. I had been shy then, and he had been gentle, always coaxing me, soothing me, stopping when I became too afraid before I screamed too much. But in Hangzhou, he said it was time I learned how to be a proper wife. I thought I was going to learn something that would make me less afraid. I was still nervous, of course, but I was ready to learn. The first night in the little monastery room, we were lying in that narrow bed. I wore my nightgown when Fu had only his pants on. He was kissing my nose, my cheeks and shoulders, telling me how beautiful I was, how happy I made him. And then he whispered to me to say dirty words, words for a woman's body parts, not any woman's parts, a saltwater whore's, the kind who would give her body to foreign sailors. My ears hurt just to hear them. I pulled away. I cannot say those words, I finally told him. Why is this? He asked me, and he looked gentle, very concerned. A woman cannot say these things, I said, searching for a reason. And then I laughed, just a little, to show him I was embarrassed even thinking about it. Suddenly his smile went away, and he was a different person. He sat up quickly. His face was ugly, mad, and I became scared. I sat up too and stroked his shoulder, eager to win him back. Say them, he shouted suddenly. He repeated the words, 3 or 4 dirty words. Say them, he shouted again. I shook my head and began to cry, and then he became tender again, wiping my eyes and saying how much he cared for me, rubbing my back and my neck until I thought I would faint with relief and joy. He was only teasing, I thought happily. How stupid of me. And then he was helping me to stand up. He lifted my nightgown off, and when I was naked, he took my 2 hands and looked at me sincerely. Say them, he said in a quiet voice. And hearing this once again, I started to collapse to the floor. But before I could do so, he pulled me back up, dragged me toward the door like a bag of rice. He opened the door, then pushed me outside into the corridor of the monastery, where anyone passing by could have seen me naked like that. What could I do? I could not shout. Someone would awake and look out and see me. So I was whispering to him through the door, pleading, open the door, open. And he said nothing, did nothing, until several minutes had passed and I finally said, I will say them. After that, it was the same way every night. Here is where you should imagine more. Here is where you should make it worse.
I think that those last sentences are among my favorite in your novel, the idea of here's where you should imagine more, here's where you should make it worse. It communicates to me a couple of things, you know, both the shyness of the mother and, you know, her difficulty in talking about this, but also the inability of words to convey the proper degree of pain and horror. Did your mother say that to you when she was telling you the story?
She did in the same tone of feeling, where she almost could not explain in English to me how bad it really was. And she also felt that with the experiences I had lived through as an American, that I couldn't possibly understand what it was that was so much worse. And it was also very painful for her, because as my mother was telling me about her life, she would jump up or she would wave her arms, and I could see in her eyes as though she was reliving exactly what was happening at that time. And I was afraid to ask when she said, here's where you should imagine that it was worse. At that point, she could see in my eyes I was afraid to ask. What was it?
But did you ask anyways?
There were times when I couldn't. I simply couldn't. I could see, you know, because of the tears in her eyes. And I would wait and let her tell me what she was willing to tell me. Sometimes things would come out, you know, days later or months later. She would say, remember that time I told you about what happened to my baby or something? And then she would tell me more about that time. And I could see that over the months she had that transformation of being able to bring out more and more and more and tell me what she was feeling. But at the time, I didn't want to ask because I felt this was her story. This was her way of telling me.
It's really very difficult, I think, for most mothers and daughters to talk about anything sexual, let alone for a mother to tell the daughter about how she was sexually abused. Do you think if you hadn't been a novelist, if you hadn't started telling stories about your mother's generation, that she would never have told you this?
I think in a way she wouldn't have told me in such detail, because she had told me things about her marriage and about being tortured. The way she would tell me was, I was mentally tortured. You cannot imagine. It was like my skin would be crawling every single day, every minute, every moment, and I couldn't stand it and I couldn't get away. But it took a while before she could tell me where that feeling came from. And I think it was with the ears of both a novelist and a daughter that she was able to go into much more of where those feelings came from. And I think she knew that I was listening with my heart, because as she would tell things and she would be crying, I would be crying with her. But not holding back and not wanting to say too much, because I wanted it to be completely her story and not trying to shape questions to get something out that I wanted as a novelist.
Has she read the novel yet?
Oh, yes, yes. She read early drafts, and she would laugh at times and say, oh, that's not the way that it happened. I didn't know this person named Hulan, or I never knew a person named Peanut. And at times she would think that it was so true. She'd see names that she of people that she knew who are not characters in the book but just happen to be the same names, and she'd say, oh, how can you write about Helen, you know? And I'd say, no, it's not the same Helen. And she would tell me, she said, it is the same feelings that she had, and I know that you changed this. I felt by time she read through to the end of the book, she felt so strongly about people knowing not only what had happened to her, but what had happened to my grandmother, her mother. These were secrets within the family. And there are family members who disagree, who feel that these should have remained secrets. But now she feels it's necessary. It's, as she told me, she said, people say that the past is something you can't change. You should just accept it. That's how things were in China. And she said, I can never accept it. I can never accept what happened to me, what happened to my mother. Why should I? And her feeling is that somehow we can still change the past, at least in our understanding of it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Tan, and her new novel is called The Kitchen God's Wife. So a lot of the story about the mother in this novel is based on your mother's story. I'm wondering about the story of the daughter. Did you learn when your mother was talking to you about her life that you, like the daughter in the novel, are really the daughter of the first husband, the cruel husband, and not the second husband?
No. My mother actually laughed about that part, and she said, you have to tell people I was married to that man for only 10 years. She told me that last night on the phone, and it wasn't 12 years, because she said, you really are the daughter of the father you always thought was your father. And in fact, I am the second born of my mother's second marriage, so it would have been my brother who was born in 1950. But no, that was not the case. I think, though, within every family, mothers and daughters have secrets from one another. And sometimes they're very heavy secrets, and sometimes they're just things about ourselves. But you know, I'm glad to say that is not the case with me.
You know, part of her novel is about the power of secrets and how people think that if they reveal this to someone who they love, that the person they love won't be able to take it. It'll just, like, kill them, or they'll be driven crazy by it. And really what happens is this real deepening of understanding between the mother and the daughter when the secrets are revealed.
Yes, I think that they both go through a sense of how they look at the world and realize that they both share similar fears. In this mother, and what has always struck me as remarkable about my mother is that in spite of everything that's happened to her, she manages somehow to not simply survive, but to find some way to look at her life, to deal with, to come up with a hope of making the world different somehow. And I feel that she passed that on to me. And I think in this case, that in this story, the mother also wants her daughter to confront the fears that she had, that she thinks that she might have given to her daughter, and for them both to look at the world differently.
Novelist Amy Tan is my guest, the author of the bestseller The Joy Luck Club and a new novel called The Kitchen God's Wife. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Amy Tan is my guest. Has it been difficult to get your mother's voice or the voice of her generation as a writer? I know it's a voice you've heard all of your life, but that doesn't mean it's easy to get it when you're writing.
It was a challenge because I think when you write in a voice that's different, if it's an Asian American voice, that you know you can very quickly go to the point of parody and have a voice that just sounds very comical. I wanted to find a voice that was her voice, meaning conveyed her passions and her intent and the nature of her thoughts, and at the same time, her intelligence and her way of looking at the world. I had used... started off with the Chinese thinking, which is how my mother talks. She translates directly from Chinese, and her language is full of images and expressions that you wouldn't find in English. And I would take that in, then I would change it to another kind of language. And so it's something in between. But I did have to work on that for quite a while, and now it becomes... that it's easy, but it's something that has become much more natural. When I get into the rhythm of that, suddenly I begin to think like this character. I begin to talk in the same way. And it's a combination. It's not simply the language. A language is connected to the kinds of thoughts that it expresses.
Forgive me for asking this. I don't want to be like your literal reader who takes everything literally. But I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't ask you this. The daughter in your novel, I mean, her big secret that she doesn't want to tell her mother is that she has MS. And I just thought I should check to see if there's anything.
You know, I wondered if anybody would ask me that. And I am very fortunate in that I don't have any serious medical problems. I do have a number of friends who have serious conditions that are debilitating and will be with them for the rest of their lives. But on the other hand, you know, I look at some of the kinds of secrets, painful secrets that I also have, you know, and there's some things I think everybody has in their own time and place have to reveal, and I thought about it in those terms.
Mm-hmm. Because your first book was so popular, I'm sure you're doing, like, thousands of interviews for the new book. Are you afraid of being used up in interviews? And, I guess you could say it's very two-faced of me to be asking this, since I'm one of the many people who's kind of, you know, asking you more and more questions, trying to drag more and more out of you. But I think that there is this kind of justifiable fear when you're interviewed a lot that the things that you're storing up, you're going to use up in the interview.
Well, I don't. I mean, I do hold back, and I also know the things that I'm thinking about in terms of my next book. I certainly don't reveal those kinds of thoughts. But what I have learned is that it's great to talk about the new book during a certain period. But then when I go back to writing, I do have to be completely by myself, and I can't be talking about a book that I've already written or about books that I think I'm going to write. I have to be a very, very private person. If I have a sense of a public, then I become self-conscious, and that degree of honesty that must be there in fiction starts to evaporate.
You wrote a piece about how your life was changed by the success of your first novel, and you wrote about how you're getting all these offers, like judging the Miss Universe contest and posing for a Gap jeans ad. Did you go through a lot of crises about what your responsibilities were to do things for other people and what your responsibility was to your next book?
Well, I did, because I think especially as an Asian American writer, I felt this pull. There were so many people who said, now we have a voice for our community, and, you know, we do need you to help raise money for this cause, or you can be the person who speaks out about this and that. And I did think that what had happened to me was a great deal of luck, and it was a privilege to be published. And then I realized what I also had to do, that my most important task was not speaking out on issues and being a spokesperson for 10 dozen different things. My responsibility was to write fiction, and that was the best thing I could do. I now do things, but I choose them very carefully, and I just have to realize, like everyone, I have limitations in terms of time and energy.
One last thing. Have you been revealing a lot to your mother in the past few years, as she's been revealing a lot to you?
I do reveal thoughts that I have about... we talk a little bit about, you know, the success of this book and what it means, and about luck, and about my feelings about my father, which were very difficult for me to talk about. We talk about, compare our perspectives on what happened as I was growing up as a child, and misunderstandings. And now we can give both sides and laugh about it and come up with a new version. That's been a wonderful, tremendous thing. I think that's also what happens in fiction. I mean, if there's anything that I've learned as a fiction writer, is that there is no absolute truth to anything. And it really takes, you know, sometimes several viewpoints, or hundreds of viewpoints, or in the case of war, millions of viewpoints, before you come to the truth of something.
Amy Tan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And my guest has been Amy Tan. Her new novel is called The Kitchen God's Wife. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Patricia Williams' great-great-grandmother was a slave. Her great-great-grandfather was a slave owner and a white attorney. Patricia Williams is a lawyer and one of the few black women law professors. Coming up, she talks with us about racism and the law. It's the subject of her new book. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews new albums by two bands who play New York's downtown clubs. And what's in a name? Commentator Maureen Carrigan says quite a lot if you're a bride deciding whether or not to take your husband's name. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to reports from Colombia, Pablo Escobar has surrendered to court officials. The man alleged to be a leader of the Medellin drug cartel is said to have been taken to a special jail in his hometown outside of Medellin. If true, the surrender came just hours after a constitutional convention voted to ban extradition. While such a ban has been opposed by U.S. officials, many Colombians believe that it may bring an end to drug-related violence. The use of a government limousine by White House Chief of Staff John Sununu to attend a rare stamp auction in New York City is generating more embarrassment for the Bush administration. NPR's Kay McFadden has more on the story.
If John Sununu's political future is in jeopardy here at the White House, no one could tell it from President Bush's behavior today. He and other Republican leaders rallied round the chief of staff, defending Sununu's mixing of business and personal matters while traveling. The president pointed out that Sununu worked on White House projects while riding in the limousine to New York, adding that it was important not to confuse impressions with reality.
Nobody likes the appearance of impropriety. On the other hand, I think fairness dictates you ought to look at the particular fact about it. And so that's my view.
However, the president also made it clear that he regarded the trip as a rare occurrence, indicating Sununu's use of taxpayer limousines soon might become as restricted as his use of military planes. At the White House, I'm Kay McFadden.
In Capitol Hill, the Senate plans to send its 5-year transportation plan to the House tonight after reaching agreement on how to compensate states that claim that they were shortchanged in highway funds. Members are close to approval of the $123 billion measure. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
Although the major fight over how to split up the highway funds was settled yesterday by handing out an additional $8.2 billion, some members are still not ready to support the bill. Democrat Bob Graham of Florida.
We are not, in fact, passing an infrastructure recovery plan. We are not contributing to America's economic strength by this. To the contrary, we are presiding over the decline of the American transportation system.
Graham says members are kidding themselves if they think $123 billion will solve the nation's highway needs. But he's more upset over the formula by which federal aid is distributed. Graham supports a method that would give money to the states on the basis of need and the use of highways, but it was defeated 57-41. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 31 points to close at 2,955.50. on volume of some 159 million shares. This is NPR News. In Berlin, Albania has now been admitted to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, becoming the 35th member of the group. That country's foreign minister conceded that his nation is now in urgent need of aid, adding that a self-reliance policy has been a failure. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union and other nations have differed over a plan to settle urgent problems in Europe. Moscow and several other nations turned down a proposed system that would have allowed any 6 member states to call a special meeting of the group. The judge in the William Kennedy Smith rape case in Palm Beach, Florida, has issued a gag order that is more liberal than one proposed at a hearing almost 2 weeks ago. Todd Rosenthal reports.
The 13-page gag order issued by Palm Beach Circuit Judge Mary Lupo prevents anyone involved with the trial in an official capacity from discussing it in public, but places very few limitations on reporters covering the case. In an emergency hearing earlier this month, Judge Lupo said she feared that pretrial publicity could hurt Smith's chances of receiving a fair trial. She threatened to issue a gag order preventing witnesses from discussing the case outside the courtroom and also threatened to seal public records from reporters. But in Wednesday's ruling, Lupo wrote that the court will place no restrictions on the media, its access to public records, or its right to be present at all court proceedings. The judge also said that if witnesses or William Kennedy Smith want to talk with reporters, they may do so without facing any penalty from the court. For National Public Radio, I'm Todd Rosenthal in West Palm Beach, Florida.
According to a U.S. educational group, 29 states have cut their budgets this year for higher education. The American Association of State Colleges and Universities says these cuts mean that many schools will have to raise their prices and some students will be forced to quit school. The group also expects hard financial times for higher education to continue. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A few years ago, the music press was always mentioning something called the downtown New York scene. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says you don't hear so much about it these days, because the music that comes out of this so-called scene is too diverse to fit under one heading. Kevin has a review of albums by two bands which illustrate this diversity. There's Dr. Nerve and this one, Curlew.
The bands Curlew and Dr. Nerve have both been around for a few years, make regular appearances at New York's home of downtown music, the Knitting Factory, and they both record for the same label, Cuneiform. But musically, their approaches are very different. Curlew's music is the more accessible. That's mostly because its chief composer, saxophonist George Cartwright, writes great, catchy little ditties. On Curlew's latest album, named B, the quintet comes across as sort of a Booker T and the MGs for the 90s. It's like the whole band is one big rolling rhythm section. Tom Cora saws away at his cello like a country fiddle player. But Curlew's more than just a peppy dance band, because its members usually take uproarious solos. Guitarist Davey Williams is the complete picker, at home with rock and roll, free improvisation, and southern blues. By the way, this stalwart of the downtown New York scene lives in Birmingham, Alabama. I really like the way his noisy guitar offsets the simple melodies. This tune is George Cartwright's St. Croix. If Curlew works on shaking your booty in a style that's at least as down-home as it is downtown, Dr. Nerve's music is more self-consciously cerebral. Their new album is called Beta 14 OK. The title refers to a level of brainwave activity. Their music has some of the taut angularity of high-minded atonal concert music, even if they play it with the recklessness of a garage band. We'll be right back. those rhythms are deliberately mechanical. In a sense, Dr. Nerve's music celebrates modern machinery, the way futurist noise concerts back before World War I exalted the internal combustion engine and the electric fan. But in Dr. Nerve's case, the machines they celebrate are computers, both the kind you find in your head and the kind that sits on your desktop. Most of the band's music is written by guitarist Nick Didkowski, who, by the way, lives in uptown, not downtown New York. But some of the music was written by a computer program Didkowski designed. The machine composed it, but the band has to play it. Here's the complete performance of Nerveware No. 1. That sounds a lot like the music that Didkowski writes himself, but then he's good at blurring the line between the animate and the inanimate. In much the same way, he softens the sound of the octet by blending electric instruments with plain old acoustic horns. Dr. Nerve also breaks down the wall between listener and performer. At the end of their new disc are 44 short musical fragments you can program on your CD player in any order you choose. Dr. Nerve's high-tech trappings aside, the band does play groove music of a sort, and Curlew's clever dance tunes aren't exactly brainless. So maybe these contrasting downtown bands really do have something in common. After all, unless you're tall enough to slam dunk a basketball, your head and your booty are never very far apart.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed new albums by Curlew and Dr. Nerve on the Cuneiform label. This is Fresh Air. Patricia Williams teaches commercial law at the University of Wisconsin. When she studies a legal contract, she often thinks back to a purchase agreement that was drawn up four generations ago, when a white lawyer named Austin Miller bought an 11-year-old slave named Sophie. Miller raped Sophie soon after he bought her, and Sophie gave birth to Williams' great-grandmother Mary. The Alchemy of Race and Rights, The Diary of a Law Professor, is the title of a new book by Patricia Williams. She writes that speaking as a black, female, and commercial lawyer has rendered her simultaneously universal, trendy, and marginal. Nevertheless, she's always bringing the subjects of race and gender into the classroom. In her book, she tells a story that she sometimes tells her students.
Now, walking down Fifth Avenue in New York not long ago, I came up behind a couple and their young son. The child, about 4 or 5 years old, had evidently been complaining about big dogs. The mother was saying, "But why are you afraid of big dogs?" "Because they're big," he responded with eminent good sense. "But what's the difference between a big dog and a little dog?" the father persisted. "They're big," said the child. "But there's really no difference," said the mother, pointing to a large, slathering wolfhound with narrow eyes and the calculated amble of a gangster, and then to a beribboned Pekingese the size of a roller skate who was flouncing along just ahead of us all in that little foxtrotty step that keep Pekingese from ever being taken seriously. "See," said the father. "If you look really closely, you'll see there's no difference at all. They're all just dogs." And I thought, talk about your ironclad cannon. Talk about a static, unyielding, totally uncompromising point of reference. These people must be lawyers. Where else do people learn so well the idiocies of high objectivity? How else do people learn to capitulate so uncritically to a norm that refuses to allow for difference? How else do grown-ups sink so deeply into the authoritarianism of their own worldview that they can universalize their relative bigness so completely that they obliterate the subject positioning of their child's relative smallness? To say nothing of the position of the slathering wolfhound, from whose own narrow perspective, I dare say the little boy must have looked exactly like a lamb chop.
This story about the boy who's afraid of big dogs is a story that you sometimes tell in your classes. What are you trying to illustrate by way of this story?
I am trying to illustrate the position of the three-year-old who wants protection against big dogs. And what I am doing metaphorically or in a slightly different context is I think what I am representing in a context that is perhaps less emotionally loaded than in race or gender, the position of relatively disenfranchised people, of relatively less powerful people who make a claim that they see something big and potentially devouring down the line. Can they have protection against it? And the law's response is, but there's no danger, but there's no power difference, even when that is utterly absurd from the disenfranchised person's perspective.
Is there a time in your life where you felt like this boy who was being told, oh, no, all dogs are the same. You shouldn't worry about those big dogs.
Many, many instances. One that comes to mind being here in New York is I went to a store in Soho a little while ago, and there has been in New York an outcropping of buzzers on doors.
We have to get buzzed to let in. They lock the door, and you have to ring the bell to get in.
Yes, and you have to ring the bell to get in. And there's been a great deal of discussion in the New York media about the fact that frequently who is buzzed in or who is not buzzed in is a racial determination based on so-called security profiles of who's likely to be a shoplifter or a robber. And somehow all blacks fit the profile of being shoplifters or muggers. Anyway, I went to the store, which I'd been to 1,000 times before, pressed the little buzzer, and they would not let me in. And the store was clearly opened. There were other people in the store, white people in the store. I wrote my sense of rage and disenfranchisement up in an essay, and I was invited to submit this essay to a law review, and during the second edit, they eliminated all reference to my race in this story. And the story, without knowledge of my race, became one either in which I became paranoid. There simply was no basis for my accusations of discrimination without that knowledge. Or it was one in which the reader had to assume that I was black by reading it. And in that process of assumption, to engage in a kind of prejudgment of who I must be, and I use prejudgment quite calculatedly as the root of the word prejudice. And in fact, the editor even said, oh, anyone reading the story will know what you must have looked like. At the same time, the official rationale for taking out all reference to my race was cloaked in words that would have been worthy of those parents talking to the young boy about the big dogs. The official reason was, it is a matter of style. We're not explicitly eliminating reference to race. It has nothing to do with race. It is simply a matter of style. Our style book says that there shall be no descriptions of physiognomy. So again, it was legalized, and by legalized, I mean it conformed to the law's best-loved inculcations, which are impersonality, neutrality. You don't use words that are at all emotion-laden, and race, as we see, is increasingly emotion-laden. But yet at the same time, it cut out the heart of what this story was about.
So there's times when you think that objectivity and color blindness actually work against you if you are a person of color.
Well, I think that objectivity and color blindness can become precisely subjectivity, like the parent position or the white storekeeper position, as a way of not hearing the little boy position or the brown me standing on the doorstep of the store not being able to get in position. And so what, in fact, you call objectivity is, in fact, a contest between two different subjectivities.
I think what you're saying is that sometimes colorblindness or objectivity means just seeing it through the point of view of the mainstream or the people in power.
Yes, or becomes, yes, a certain kind of privilege of one view over another, or blindness rather than mere colorblindness.
I want to leave aside the word politically correct, but I want to ask
you... That's fine.
I want to ask you what's bothering you, though, about what's happening on campus now in the way that race and gender are being handled.
What I think is happening is multi-leveled. On the one hand, you have an invocation of the First Amendment in a way that blinds one to the moral censure involved, so that you really have what I think is a discussion that's almost beside the point. I am a staunch defender of the First Amendment, but almost any time I raise issues of how race and gender are discussed, people say I am interfering with somebody's First Amendment rights, so that the issue of legal censoring replaces the discussion of moral censure. And we desperately need a discussion of moral censure. And the First Amendment is never absolute in that sense anyway. I mean, people cannot call their bosses racial epithets, and yet certainly you have a First Amendment right to do so, but the issue in the workplace is clearly not that. People can't... It is almost, for example, as though somebody who started yelling and screaming drunkenly all over the place would clearly be able to be dismissed from an academic environment as being sort of crazy. But if, while they were yelling drunkenly and falling over all over the place, as in the Brown incident, the Brown student who was dismissed, if they also yell racial epithets or gender slurs, then somehow they become a hero. And I find that very troubling, and we need to discuss the power implications of that. It is almost as though people are saying, I have my First Amendment right to call you nigger, so you shut up about it. That seems to me the tenor of these discussions.
Patricia Williams is the author of The Alchemy of Race and Rights. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Boris Yeltsin, as you know, is in Washington, the elected leader of the Russian Republic. We'll have a story on what he's up to and what people think about him, and some stories from the Soviet Union as well. We also will take a look at the abortion bill, which passed the Louisiana legislature over the governor's veto yesterday, and ask Nina Totenberg what sort of a challenge that bill will make to Roe v. Wade. We're also going to talk about the hole in the ozone layer and hear from a controversial feminist.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. June is the big month for weddings. Commentator Maureen Corrigan says she's disappointed in one aspect of the modern marriage.
Here are the results of the bridal name change survey based on my reading of the New York Times wedding announcements page. Out of 52 announcements in a recent Sunday Times, only 6 mentioned that the bride was keeping her name. Elizabeth Loring Crane is one of those stubborn brides. She got married to William Mushkin, and their announcement told us that Ms. Crane, 28 years old, is known as Betsy. She is keeping her name. Keeping her name, what a weird phrase that is. Imagine if that announcement had read, "The groom, Mr. Mushkin, is 29 years old, and he is keeping his name." Well, of course he is, and so are the other 51 grooms. Why shouldn't they? They're getting married, not entering a witness protection program. The overwhelming majority of women whose weddings are announced in the Times are college-educated professionals. So I think that their general willingness to lose their names is pretty surprising. Sure, it's been a custom over the centuries for women to take on their new husband's last names. But that custom signifies a belief about the proper balance of power in a marriage. A woman lost her name to publicly signify the loss of her autonomy. In the 70s and 80s, lots of women challenged this traditional model of marriage by holding on to their names, or at least hyphenating them. But these are more socially conservative times. Gradually, the first half of many of those hyphenated names has eroded away. And as a one-year marriage veteran, I can tell holdouts like Betsy Crane that dry cleaners, dentists, and landlords will insist on calling her Mrs. Mushkin. My own parents, who should know better, began calling me by my husband's last name right after the ceremony ended. I gently corrected them, and now they address letters to us as Maureen Corrigan and Richard. It's like there can only be one last name per married couple. Of course, lots of women don't mind changing their names. I was at the Motor Vehicles Bureau a few weeks ago, and a woman ahead of me online was complaining about waiting an hour and a half to get a new license. She had just gotten married, she said, and she needed a license in her new name. I wonder how many other bureaucratic forms she must have already had to fill out in order to erase her old identity. To people who say, "What's the big deal about a woman changing her name?" I say, what man would change his, let alone wait in line to do it? And as for the question of what last names the kids get, well, flip a coin. What's the big deal? But feminist sentiments like these are unpopular right now, even among the young. A student of mine who's getting married soon told me that her identity is rooted in her first name, Michelle, not her last name. I thought her argument was preposterous, but maybe she's on to something. Maybe both women and men should lose their last names when they get married. We could take our cue from famous first-name-only couples like Othello and Desdemona, Babar and Celeste, Tarzan and Jane, and let's not forget the Ur couple, Adam and Eve. Since we're living in such a backward-looking age, we may as well go all the way.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Voblaitis, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer André Debus discusses his work and how it was changed by an accident that crippled him. Also, we talk with athlete and sports writer Mariah Burton Nelson about her own short-lived career in pro basketball and about what women athletes are up against in sports that are controlled by men. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.